Hello and welcome to episode 77 of The Crate and Crowbar. It is the 27th of January, 2015. My name is Chris Thurston and today I am joined by Marsh Davies.
Hello.
And Tom Senior.
Hello.
This has been a big week for the profile of people whose essays we've read about PC game stuff. As a man who wrote many interesting essays in his role as Valve's economist goes on to become the finance minister for the new Greek government.
Yes, I think it's probably the only time I will ever interview somebody who actually has real power to change the world somehow.
It's a real opportunity for games journalists everywhere to show their total lack of suitability for the role of journalist.
Yay!
Hooray! Which is why we made loads of jokes about it and offered no further comment. But we could offer further comment that we're totally ill-equipped to
further
comment
jokes.
On now.
Further jokes.
Further jokes.
As well.
Also.
Is this the best thing to ever happen in gaming news? Everyone should realise the crossover between spheres is just too rare and precious.
It's very rare that anything that we think about or care about crosses over into the sphere of public interest to this degree.
Absolutely.
Except when it's awful. I think that's maybe the big takeaway for me. This isn't someone threatening a talk with a school shooting. This isn't something dreadful happening. This is a man whose expertise was applied to selling internet hats being recruited to help an anti-austerity government turn around the Greek economy.
To bring down the oligarchy, I think, was one of the phrases that we used.
Indeed.
Which is quite scary, really.
Yeah, definitely.
And I know nothing about economics, or really the world, but it seems to me that, you know, Valve have always had a really unorthodox way of doing things. Mm. When it comes to, at least, gaming, they have made a lot of money by doing things very differently to how any other publisher would sell things. You know, proving that discounts work to such an exponential degree that it's now sort of accepted that 90% discounts actually make you more money. Stuff like that. And that's all part of this thing that they've constructed around Steam Workshop and around TF2 initially and then Dota 2 that has allowed them to spend things that you would never think a human being would pay for, like a weed emoticon, or a lump of Dota coal, or a hat that's on fire, or a promotional item for a different game, and turn this into a profitable marketplace that is now self-sustaining. You know, Valve don't necessarily even need to add new products to that system to make money from it. Completely in contravention to how any other publisher did things for a long time, and in many ways, common sense. And that kind of radical thinking is rarely applied to real economics, because actual lives would be the
same. Yeah, we'll see how that goes.
Well, you've got to spend money in a recession, so they say. So maybe you make everything really cheap. Do you apply Steam Cell logic to a nation?
I love the idea of applying game design to government in some way. It reminds me of the Ian M. Banks book, Player of Games, which is basically the story of a massful player of games who gets sent to this planet where their entire cultural hierarchy is based on people's ability to play this extraordinary Uber game through which you can express your political views and your philosophies and, you know, outwit people with them. And so, like, it's like a philosophical battleground that happens on this game board. And their entire society is derived from people's success in this game.
It's a really good book. And one of its really important conclusions is that, ultimately, that's kind of bullshit.
Yes, that's true. But it does have a badass bit with the planet that's permanently on fire.
Yeah. You should read it for a man attempting to finish a game of hyperspace politics chess before the flaming equinox of a tidally locked planet consumes everybody.
That's a book.
That probably won't happen in Greece.
One hopes not, but we know it's good 5 years.
So I think what we've established is that I have no idea. What's going on, or what impact it might have? Marsh?
I have no idea. Don't know.
Great.
I have opinions on economics now, because I've read a economics book.
Perfect.
But not enough to know whether what their plans are in Greece.
That attitude is holding you back from a column somewhere.
Yes, never willingly admit ignorance. That's yeah, the way to go.
I really look forward to this weekend's games journalists just wading the fuck into this thing.
Yeah.
And they understand and just doing op-eds about it, and just yeah, it's going to be very entertaining, if not actually useful to the human race in any way.
Look out for them op-eds.
Mm-hmm.
But from Greek finance, something we can't really expertly talk about, to Grim Fandango.
Yes.
Something we can, or Tom can, because he's played it, which played was re-released this week.
It was the remastered version of the 1998 classic LucasArts adventure game.
Finally, something within our purview.
I know things about this. It's been launched on GOG and Steam. As of midnight.
On GOG and Steam.
GOG and Steam. and it's still great. It's brilliant whenever adventure games are re-released, because they simultaneously expose how terrible adventure games are, while also somehow still being valuable and entertaining in some way. And Grim Fandango is probably the finest example of a game that has just totally terrible puzzles. And whenever you say this in a review about an adventure game, you get commenters saying, oh, you can't handle how hard it is, you can't handle. So I'm going to take you through one of the puzzles now that is in Grim Fandango. Hopefully we'll all realise that a sane person could never solve this without trial and error. So you're trapped in the stern of the captain's room in a boat. There's a technical term for the captain's place in a boat.
Cabin.
The place where you drive the boat.
Oh. The
bridge, I guess.
Cockpit?
The
steering house.
Cockbridge, we'll call it.
The cockbridge.
And you're in there, and there are people after you, they're after your life, and you've got two buttons, one on either side. The button on the left drops the left anchor, the button on the right drops the right anchor. You can shunt the boat forwards, backwards, left and right by, about a boat length each way, and you have to escape. So I go over to the side, to one of the anchors, drop it, and use my scythe to pull in the chain and think, well, maybe, great, I've got a rope and climb down. And then just as your player character is pulled in, he just says, he shakes his head and puts it back again. So, okay, well, that would have worked according to logic, but that's not what it wants me to do. Okay. After, like, an immense amount of fiddling, I realised that you have to entangle both of the anchors below the ship, then raise both of the anchors so that they're wrapped around the ship, the belly of the ship. So they're dropping down like, pigtails either side.
Right.
And you've kind of tied them under the boat, like if you were bullying your sister when she had pigtails. Then you're required to use your scythe to pull in one of these anchors and hook it around the porthole, which I would have climbed out of to escape, ideally. Then what you do is you pull up the right anchor again, and it circumvents the belly of the boat and guts it, cutting the entire ship in half, at which point you then jet off into the sunset and escape.
On what?
On the half of the ship.
Oh, right.
That you're on, which also happens to be the half that the engines are on as well.
Right.
And
if you cut a ship in half, it's not usually considered seaworthy after that.
It's
point.
Not normally.
That's not legal, Tom.
Not legal. Or
what you've done in this skeleton-based adventure
against
game.
The Marine Code, Tom.
It's kind of weird. You have to apply, even though you're in the Land of the Dead. I should explain what it's actually about, because the premise is fucking amazing. You're in the Land of the Dead. You're playing a guy kind of full of a Hispanic Humphrey Bogart figure who's working as a guy selling sales packages, travel packages to people. To lost souls who are entering this kind of purgatorial realm. And it takes you 4 years to walk it, but if you've been a good soul in life, you can sell them a trip on the number 9, which gets you there in 4 minutes. But there's a conspiracy at work, because people who, like nuns and things who are coming in, are not getting their tickets on the number 9. They're being forced onto the long road where they get eaten by demons and kind of tied down by the dregs of humanity that are kind of stuck in between this life and the afterlife. And so you are a skeleton. And you're in a world where there are demons, and you can fly around and go, you know, there are beavers that are on fire. And yet, if you're going to have puzzles, there has to be logic. Like, even in a world where there are beavers on fire and crazy shit, the puzzles have to have some sort of logical ABC to them. Otherwise, they're not puzzles. They're just guessing what the hell, how the designer is trying to fuck with you and trying to get into the designer's head. That's really what Grim Fandango is. Just most of its puzzles are dreadful for that. So, for example, the Flaming Beavers, for example, they make dams out of the bones of people who go through this forbidden forest. And you have a fire extinguisher on you, so you think, okay, I'll just fucking spray the beavers with the fire extinguisher. Job done. But
what,
you
know, job?
The job of crossing the bony bridge to nowhere. And so, yeah, you spray them and they just reignite. So what you have to do is you have to grab a bone from their bone dam and then go down to the corner of the screen, throw a bone into the tar river, and then the beavers will jump into the tar river, and you have to hit them with the fire extinguisher as they're falling into the tar, and because they're not on fire when they hit the tar, they then sink and die. And that's,
how does
that's
the fire
the puzzle.
Keep them
exactly,
afloat?
Yeah, yeah, it's just... It's,
how does the tar river not ignite?
Yeah, I know, yeah, yeah, so many questions. it's just nonsense, and a lot of people lionize that kind of design.
No, it's raw bullshit.
It's hot bullshit. Hot flaming beaver bullshit.
I remember it being harder than other adventure games at the time because it wasn't point and click. Is that still the case? I'm having to recollect from very fuzzy memory, is it?
Yeah,
young teenager now, but
tank controls, as people could call them, because you drive Manny like a giant stupid tank. But they've fixed that now. They put point and click interface on it.
Oh, really?
Which works fine. And
okay, but are things interactable, highlighted in any way?
You right click on them, and as you mouse over them, it will kind of tell you that you can interact with it, and you can right click to choose to look at it or pick it up. Mm. And it's still got the same really ponderous inventory system, where Manny keeps everything inside his jacket. And your inventory is pulling things out of his jacket one thing at a time. And a lot of the puzzles, like the flaming beaver extinguishing puzzle, requires you to quickly select a bone and throw it, and then go into Manny's jacket for half an hour while the beaver slowly crawls towards it and then pull out another fucking thing. And yeah, it's just gooey and rubbish. However, the game is an absolute joy. Like, the world is just wonderful. The voice acting for your main character and many of the characters you meet is just exceptional and just kind of caricatured and cartoonish enough to really sell this kind of massive parody of film noir and randomly mixed with like Mexican Day of the Dead imagery and stuff. And it's just absolutely beautiful. And the central city in the middle of the game is called Rubacava. It's just one of the best adventure game locations ever created. It's just full of astonishing sights. The art is amazing. Every time you turn a corner, it's something beautiful. There's a huge race course where people race giant cats because they've kind of bastardized the Egyptian view of cats being holy, and, you know, there are all these holy giant cats around. But humans who have just stayed in poetry have decided to just monetize them. So they race them around tracks and bet on them. It's just full of these wonderful little ideas. Magnificent dialogue as well. Just jokes in every conversation you have. Everywhere you go, there's a quip or there's a line or there's a movie reference. And for something just to be so full of, you know, full of, you know, playful energy, it's so rare to see in the game world still today.
Do you think this remaster is in a... We were talking, I think it was either last week or maybe it was the week before, about games that, for example, allow you to bypass the combat in an RPG or the, you know, to kind of, to do away with the friction part of the game and just get the story bit, you know, Mass Effect 3's story mode, where the combat is trivial. Is there an opportunity in a remaster like this, do you think, to just turn the puzzles into really brief cutscenes? Where, you know, I don't know, Manny's on a boat, you gotta do a thing, he cuts the boat in half.
More often the solutions to those things are funny anyway, they would work as just visual gags as a cutscene.
As in, yeah, so, you know, the sort of action puzzle sequences, the beavers, whatever, are just turned into one-off bits of physical humour. And then you get on just exploring and enjoying the jokes. Do you think that would take away anything from the experience of the game?
I personally don't think so. But a lot of enthusiasts for the genre would be shrieking to hear this. But, I mean, I say in my review that, like, I could imagine it, if it was acceptable at the time to do this, it being a bit like a jazz punk thing, where you just move through it and you're just given everything on a plate because the joy isn't in solving the puzzles. Like, I've just felt annoyed dealing with that shit. It ruined the fun of the slapstick solutions that were presented in it as well. So, yeah, I think that would be great, personally. I think if Double Fine were to do that today, do Grim Fandango today, it would be much more like a Walking Dead style thing with little kind of quick time moments that do the slapstick stuff and not much inventory management.
Mm. What's the best LucasArts adventure of your...
I Grim Fandango is my favourite, because of the world, primarily. Because it's, like, Monkey Island's fun, but it's riffing on just pirate stuff, and it's, like, actually kind of a limited gag after a while. Whereas, yeah.
Like, my thing about why Monkey Island 2 is my favourite is because Monkey Island 2 finishes the gag and they then steadily undo Monkey Island 2's, you know, the end of Monkey Island 2, which is like the most sort of extravagant, fourth wall breaking kind of like meta ending to a joke you'll ever get. And then they just kind of dial it back in Monkey Island 3 and it's like, no, it's, no, it's not the theme park, right? Like, I really liked that, but yeah, they did turn make it just pirates after that.
Yeah.
You've also, Tom, had a chance to play a much anticipated game, Witcher 3.
Witcher 3. He's got more hair than he ever had, Geralt, of the Witcher series. Yeah, I got to play this recently for about 3 or 4 hours. And, I'm going to talk about boobs now for a little while because, the Witcher series has been known for a long time for having, like, initially incredibly dubious attitudes towards its female characters. To say the least. In fact,
they were highly collectible, those women cards.
Highly collectible. You'd meet women and then sleep with them and then unlock collectible cards for them and you could look at your deck of cards which had like people in suggestive poses and
sometimes nipples.
Yeah. So occasionally if you're lucky, it's kind of The Witcher 2 basically got rid of all that, but just had just boobs everywhere. And The Witcher 3 also just has boobs in it. But people are like, I see a lot of articles saying that it's The Witcher 3 is mature now in some ways, matured beyond The Witcher 2 and beyond the kind of adolescent fantasy that The Witcher represents. And no, it hasn't. I think people have been fooled by the HBO thing, but the HBO trick is to have ambient tits in a thing. like they're just kind of in the background.
You're talking about like the Game of Thrones exposition.
Yes, precisely. Stuff. And Rome, which they do with the BBC and their other things. And this has been aped endlessly. Like, in lots of shows that want to put boobs in things, but feel as though they have to achieve a certain degree of kind of, the pretension of artistic pretension before they're allowed to do it. So the Game of Thrones, the HBO thing is, it tries to give you the impression that, they shoot it and then it comes back to the editing studio and the guy goes, oh, Bob, look, I don't know how this happened, but we've got some boobs in the background. And it's like, oh man, shit, I don't have, how did they get there? Well, it's just the body. It's just that nature. Everyone's naked in this world all the time. So just leave them there. Just leave. Yeah.
It's partly that they're kind of like, well, we've just got this really boundless commitment to historical authenticity. And in the past, people whacked them out all the time. And in the past, everyone was a beautiful, shaven 22-year-old. And so it's just the way things are. Unfortunately, we can't do justice to this setting without them.
Everyone was hairless and had a very specific body type that is in vogue. So The Witcher 3 opens with, it turns out to be a dream, like a fantasy that Geralt's having where he's in the bathtub and, a kind of slimy creature slips in there with him and, he throws it out and kills it and his girlfriend Yennefer is there. She's a sorceress and she's totally butt naked. Writing something at a desk or something. And, then Geralt stands up and he's kind of got his ripped abs and he's scarred everywhere. And he's like adolescent masculine hero personified with all this grisliness. And, they almost break the gaming final frontier of showing a dong. Just the thing that games will never do and never have done. I've just putting a dong in it. Like they've done a lot of things.
GTA 5 did.
Oh, did they?
Yeah, there's dongs everywhere. Jesus. Oh, well, if you knew where to look for them.
We have to wait until March for that version on PC, sadly. High-res dongs. But I talked to Graham about this, because this is apparently the sort of thing I talked to Graham about. But we're talking about the dilemma of showing Geralt's penis in the game, because The Witcher series, and Geralt especially, has been designed to be this adolescent male fantasy. He is he's a mutant, which means he's immune to disease. Witches have a reputation for being amazing in bed, but they can never get anyone pregnant. So it's just like this fantasy that allows him to fuck around endlessly with no consequence. And he's also a wandering Ronin who has to deal with princesses all the time and that kind of thing. God, and it's just expressly.
He's got a cool scar.
And he's got cool scars all over him as well.
White hair.
So if you're going to show such a, like, this.
You'd have to be the most magnificent dong.
Yeah. So it's highly implied he's going to have a massive dangly ding dong. It's just like down to. But then, what if the kind of 13, 14-year-old you're kind of pitching this to is it feels inadequate having seen this.
Oh yeah.
So this is the problem. So, but they can't show him having a tiny penis because then you can't respect him as a male hero, right? So there's this dilemma where they can never, the camera can never go.
They should, you know what they should totally do? You know how they don't, so in unlike a lot of RPGs in which you play Geralt, you're always Geralt, there's no, you can't tweak who Geralt is. You know, it's not like Shepard, where you can create your own Shepard.
Yeah, well, you're saying the only part of character customization.
You have character customization only for his penis. So it does, like, he begins to dramatically spin around, and then it, like, cuts to, like, sliders.
This is a
Dial-a-Dong screen.
This is amazing to me, because that is exactly what Graham said next. When we were talking about this, like, almost word for word, he was like, oh, you should just have a character creator, you design the guy's knob, and it kind of procedurally generates the rest of him based on that. Because that's literally his identity is
the thing is, you'd get loads of guys who would do exactly this. They would make something approximating their own, and then they would put everything up to full and click accept.
They'd probably generate a few different ones, wouldn't they?
Yeah. No, full
pushing
accept.
It up, pushing it up. call it like Schrodinger's penis.
Schrodingdong.
And Graham's phrase was the Schrodonger. So this is now the Schrodonger effect, this idea that, you know,
the unseen penis is both too big and just right.
Yes. That's exactly the case with Geralt. So I really want to get that off my chest anyway.
Geralt, stop it! Do you not see the ding-dong?
You don't see it. Okay. No, you don't. I'm just challenging CD Projekt Red.
To make a more serious point out of it, this is, you know, that fear of making people feel ashamed of themselves or inadequate is exactly what they, young women have to deal with all of the time.
Yeah,
with the presentation of women. You know what I mean? It's like, to make that decision on behalf of young men who'd be like, well, we can't put a penis in this, or young men might look at themselves and go, but I'm not ripped and covered in scars and I don't have an enormous dong. Is exactly what all video games do to women. So, yeah.
How do they manage to obscure it? Is it kind of coyly obscured by an errant cucumber or something?
Sadly not. It's the bottom of the screen. It's just almost there, but not quite. I think it's funny.
They should have him get suddenly find himself aroused and have the bottom of the screen just slowly pan up. It's like his nipples.
I don't actually.
Has it got a modding community? This
game?
Well, there you go. That'll happen.
Yeah, the camera hack pans down.
Didn't someone do a camera hack of a David Cage game and found that?
The Quantum.
Quantum of Leap.
Twat.
Quantum of. Quantum Break. No. Yeah, no, that's no, the that's, new one. Beyond Two Souls?
That's the one. Mm. Yes, yeah. I think that caused a bit of a scandal. Because I don't think young actress realised that she was.
They modelled her.
I don't know if they did. I imagine. there's the legal implications of asking an actress, can we just fully scan your entire body?
Totally.
Would seem risky, but they put it all in the game. So, and then people hacked it
and found it.
Yeah.
Mm. Weird. Yeah, I don't want to insult 14-year-olds, to be honest, because, like, I'm saying that this isn't about what 14-year-old people, kids actually want. I'm saying this is what marketers think you want when they design a character like Geralt, and when they're designing a world like The Witcher, when they build it's what's perceived to be the adolescent male fantasy that they're serving.
With The Witcher, like, there is, you know, there is, the way you redeem it, because obviously it's based on a book series, it's based on a fantasy series, is you kind of, you sell it as this Robert E. Howard, Frank Frazetta drawing of a fantasy story, right? Like, the kind of heroic fantasy that basically Tolkien put out of fashion, where it is about kind of, like, hyper-masculine heroes and stuff. And obviously, it went out of fashion for a bunch of good reasons. But, you know, Conan is the example of that. Mm. And it is, you know, a genre with its roots in classical stuff, you can make a critical telling of that story, right? You can present that stuff critically if it's contextualized, right? Mm. And you can use that kind of heroic setting to do interesting things with it. Other authors have approached the Conan stuff and told other stories with characters like that that have helped dial back its more extreme elements, make it less egregious, or use its egregiousness to make a better point. The problem with The Witcher is it doesn't do that, and it exists in a context where it's not like there are, well, I suppose to an extent, you have got BioWare doing really well-balanced, socially progressive RPG work.
Yeah.
While CD Projekt Red go off and just do Conan, basically.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fine as long as there's variety of the scene. If BioWare wasn't there to do that stuff, then I'd worry that this would be the dominant idea that emerge.
That said, though, and I appreciate we should get on to talk about the actual game, but there are boobs in Inquisition and no dongs, which is a shame because that counters my argument about
Start the petition now, Chris.
Well, I mean, I'm thinking I've only seen like one of the romance scenes in Inquisition, but one of the men's two characters kind of like, lying outside under the stars, and it's a torso up shot for both of them. But one of them's female, and she's topless. And obviously, like, there isn't a below the waist shot of either of them. And so maybe you'd have to have the guy lying the other way around. But in fairness, it's still female bodies that are more exposed in games as opposed to.
I think there are a lot of laws people are dealing with when they're showing penises as well, which are going to vary enormously from territory to territory. But like, there's a ludicrous law in Britain about like what angle constitutes an erect penis or a not erect penis, and what's allowed to be shown at what time. And if it's that complicated in the UK, then like in the US and everywhere else, it's going to be a mental minefield, isn't it?
Yeah, I suppose it does tap into too much. Bigger social issues at that point, but still, you would in a game that sets out to be as responsible with its presentation of gender as Inquisition does, you kind of want bodies to be treated as equally valid in terms of exposing them for whatever artistic effect you're trying to have.
Yeah.
Again, you still run up against the problem of the player character penis.
But BioWare's all about sliders, so you know.
Yeah, they are all about the sliders. Actually, Saints Row, the only series to have a penis slider.
Very true.
Yeah, I don't remember
the size of the mosaic.
Blurs it out,
yeah. I remember you couldn't see it.
Yeah.
Though it was physics modeled.
And how?
A wistful look comes across Marsh's face momentarily as he contemplates.
So enough dick talk.
Yeah, so is there anything you guys actually want to know about The Witcher 3 beyond, Geralt?
What do you do in it?
So you go around talking to peasants who have problems, and the problem is normally something that's eating the peasants, and you go and solve that problem by killing the thing that's eating the peasants. This normally involves going to like a local crime scene where they've basically lifted wholesale the Batman Arkham series detective mode, where you activate Witcher Vision and scan the environment for things, for glowing clues, and then you walk up and he'll say something about them, and he'll deduce that, you know, a giant was slain here or something, or it's probably a griffin, and then journal will update. And one of my favourite things about The Witcher 3 actually is its journal, its monster journal, which I described as being like a Pokédex, basically, that you keep as you go through the world, you find monsters, and it will give you a quite well-written description of what the monster is, its history, and how it could be killed, and everything has certain potions and oils that you'll need to coat the blade in order to be effective against it. Some monsters will only come out at certain times of day, so you'll have to camp there and prepare and meditate and, you know, get ready for this, you know, whatever encounter you've got.
Probably a griffin.
We'll talk about the griffin fight in a minute because it's the worst bit of the demo, actually. Really good example of this was the game's side quests are incredibly involved. Like, none of the quests were just like a 2-minute hand this note to someone or go fetch that ram or something. There's a guy who the territory's been taken, it's kind of war-torn. There are so many corpses in the rivers that no one can drink the water from the rivers anymore. So they're forced to go to the local well, but the local well is haunted. So you go up to the local well, it's in this little abandoned kind of village, and the world is fucking extraordinarily beautiful. Just a dynamic world where, you know, there's changing weather all the time, the changing times of day, just painted completely different colours. And it's all beautifully modelled, and I was talking to the level designer, it says that they hand place everything. That obviously they'll have kind of things where they can paint grass and stuff, and it'll procedurally generate to an extent. But they haven't beamed in a load of terrain and procedurally generated terrain. They've mapped everything and placed everything, which means that you're constantly seeing just portraits as you walk around the world. You'll turn a corner and there'll be something someone's designed for you to see, and it looks fucking astonishingly beautiful. It's going to be an amazing game just to take a walk. So you're coming up to this abandoned little village, this kind of slightly overgrown, all the buildings around are collapsed. Activate detective vision. There's a horrible well in the middle as well, and it's already quite sinister. There's a charred dog in the reeds. There's some, you know, charring around the well. You go to the house, you find a journal of a guy who's, you know, talking about his wife who went missing. And he deduces that it's a noon wraith who comes around.
What wraith?
A noon wraith. which is a spirit that appears at midday.
Oh, right.
Every day. Not a moon wraith.
Nude wraith.
could be.
That's the only thing that wasn't nude, I think, actually. and if you actually... I accidentally encountered the nude wraith by just going through that area at midday. So, like, it's a dynamic thing that's happening there. That place is literally haunted. It's not the thing that is triggered by activating the quest. Obviously, it's quite hard to kill because you don't know anything about it. So there's a very specific way of killing it. And so to unravel this mystery, I had to go down into the well and go underwater. And, you know, I was expected to be attacked at any time. And found this medallion that was obviously important to the person who'd become this wraith. So I swam back up again and placed this medallion in with the bones of the person and then ignited it and summoned the wraith. And something it kind of then suddenly he's like, yes, it's a noon wraith, and your journal activates and you can look into the journal and it says, oh, you need to trap it inside your trap spell and that will give it corporeal form and then you can hit it with your silver sword in order to take it out. And that's exactly what I did, and I got to this really exciting fight with this extraordinary model of a spirit where it's just this dark shadow, and as soon as it comes into the circle of glyphs you cast on the floor, it becomes a howling banshee. It's like flying linen and kind of ghastly giant mouth sneering at you, and you kind of beat it back with your silver sword, and then you have to retreat a bit and cast another glyph, and eventually you kill it and dispel it, banish it. And it's just a fucking side quest in the game. That's not a thing you do as part of the main quest. That's just the thing you can pick up in a village. I talked to a random peasant and he wanted some water, and then I got into that.
That sounds fucking amazing.
It was fantastic. And that's where The Witcher 3 is going to shine, because in a completely different part of the game, the second part of the demo, which is in the Skellige region, which is basically like Highland Scotland with Vikings. And I just went down from this beautiful castle that's like built into this crag in the sea, and just kind of walked down to the very base of the crag where there are these peasants building ships for trade. And this immense sense of hustle and bustle to the places. The animations for just idle peasants are terrific, and you can feel like they're kind of rowing and doing peasant things. And got talked to a fisherman, and he was talking about how his mate had been dragged into the water by drowners, which are basically men in battles. Their bodies are thrown into the river, and some of them just come back, and they're as these horrible, ghoulish creatures. And that kicked off a whole quest where to find the drowner lair, and it involved me going to the northern coast of the island, and then swimming out and finding a lagoon and then going in there. And there's all this kind of hanging gas. They're kind of horrible bilious emissions just kind of hanging in there around these corpses. And if you use your fire spell, it ignites that and causes these massive chain explosions that kill huge numbers of them. And, yeah, that was another side quest that I just got by just walking around the place. And it's going to be cool. it's going to be cool, I think. I think that it's got its problems. Like, combat is...
Well, I was going to ask that, yeah. Because the previous two Witcher games have always been a bit flaky. The first Witcher game, terrible combat. The second one changed it completely, I seem to remember, but was also a dump.
It's basically almost exactly the same as the second game. He's got the same set of spells, and we had to play with controllers because the Master Keyboard stuff wasn't ready yet. And he's got five spells, and they're basically essential. There's one spell, which is a protection spell, which casts a shield that will negate a hit. Is just absolutely essential. Like, there's no reason for you to never have that up, and it regenerates every so often. So you've got the situation where you're just constantly casting it all the time, and it should just be a passive. It shouldn't be a chore to have to put that up every 30 seconds. Trouble is, you also want to use your other spells a lot, like your fire spell and your trap spell. And every time you have to do that, you have to hold down a menu which pauses the combat to select the spell from a wheel. And you've only got five spells. You could easily cycle it or put them on the D-pad or something. And it's just chops at combat. It's not very good. The kind of dodge mechanics are kind of okay if you're fighting another human, and there's a parry mechanic which works against humans with weapons that are hitting you, but a lot of the things that are hitting you are weird monsters of varying sizes, and the combat system hasn't really been designed, it feels like, for anything larger than a human. So the fight against the griffin, this momentous fight, and you get this amazing introduction to it where you come across a dead horse and a screaming peasant in the road, and the griffin attacks you, and then you know, you defend yourself, and then it comes screeching back and picks up the horse whole and just takes it off to its lair, and then you go and find it, and it looks amazing, but then you get into the fight and you can't lock onto it, and then you have to shoot it down with a crossbow without really being able to lock onto it. And then, you know, okay, so you send it crashing back down to Earth. Again, that looks spectacular. And then you wade in to hit it, and it kind of shrugs and hits you at an unexpected angle, and there's no way to get close in on it. There's no move that lets you just kind of dive in and hit it. Mm. I'm just kind of swatting at its haunches, and some of the hits aren't registering, some of them are. Then he swings his head, and I swear it's like bullshit, it never hits me, but it does, and takes off loads of damage. And it's just, it's just really messy and doesn't quite work, which is a real shame. And of course, there's still a few months to go, like, they still might be tuning this stuff, but it feels like that's going to be the game's major weakness. It's going to be those bites of it, the bigger things.
Is it easy? Can I just turn that stuff off and wander around looking at stuff?
I was on medium, so hopefully the easy mode is actually really forgiving, because I think as a game to just wander through, it's going to be fantastic. Mm. The other thing is that, like, it requires a lot of crafting-y things when it comes to brewing potions with alchemy and stuff like that, too. That's just always been very involved in the Witcher series, and it's kind of been a big part of its RPG cred, if you like, amongst RPG hardcore fans. And that's still in it for people who enjoy that. But hopefully they'll kind of... Hopefully on easy mode, it won't need you to go out and find the herbs to get the right oil for the monster and that kind of stuff.
Marsh, you recently have been taking your first steps in a genre that is famous for the number of dicks it showcases.
Very good.
Fuck that up a little bit.
It's actually not my first dabble in the waters of MOBA, although it wasn't called MOBA when I used to play them.
What did they used to call them?
Dota-likes.
No.
Don't know. Did they even have a name for it back when...
The nameless genre that was.
Yeah.
Dota-like was used, I believe. It's one of the reasons that... Well, because MOBA was an invention of Riot.
Mm. Was it? I don't recall. Anyway, yes, I've been playing Blizzard's MOBA, the name of which I've forgotten.
Heart of the Stone.
That's right, yes. The famous Heart of the Stone. Heroes of the Storm. And Owen's been going on at me for ages to play it with him, and eventually I've cracked. I was thinking, oh god, it's just going to be fucking Dota for babies. I don't even like Dota. And it is Dota for babies. But I really like Dota for babies. I'm a baby. and it's great. I think, yeah, it's interesting talking to you about it, Chris, because you had a lot of reservations about its comparative lack of complexity, which is definitely apparent even to me. I mean, I asked you a question about a pro build of a hot character earlier today, and you were like, "Oh, it's so cute! Look at one of the ones for a Dota character, and it's like eight times as long." And having tried to play Dota 2, it's also apparent to me how much easier and accessible hots is, and I understand that the reasons why that may make it an inferior game for you, and indeed for anybody who wants it to turn into this kind of sport, which is just this infinite knowledge ceiling and infinite skill ceiling. But if you want to play a competitive game with your friends for maybe 13 hours and then never play the game, then I think it's actually pretty ideal for that. And it kind of serves a different purpose. I was wondering, I was thinking about this today, building up to this grand and probably spurious theory about why people play games. I was thinking that, broadly, people who play games fall on a spectrum between wanting it as a broadcast medium and wanting it to be a medium by which you receive. And I think most people like a bit of both, and they find a bit of both in each game and maybe in different games. And obviously, when I'm in a game, I want to express myself within the context of that world. But ultimately, that game has to be giving me something. It needs to be bringing something to me and feeding me like a little baby. Because if I want to just purely express myself, I'll go off and draw a picture of a dong. But I think a lot of other people, especially people who like multiplayer games and competitive games, and certainly things like MMOs, and they use it as a means of self-expression to the extent that I don't know. Do you agree with this principle at all? So
I
far?
Do. Yeah. I was gonna, because something like this came up recently on I was streaming Smite and somebody who may actually be a podcast listener, I've just totally forgotten who it was, said something like, I've completely also forgotten the question, but the spirit of it was, you know, if you're not having fun with a competitive game, if you're getting frustrated, stop playing. I know what it was. I was on a huge winning streak in Smite. Like, I was on, like, a 12-game winning streak.
Hmm.
And I was saying, oh, well, you know, if I lose this one, I'll start playing other characters. Because I was on a streak particularly because of the character I was playing, the one I'm okay at.
Hmm.
And in my head, I was like, I'm enjoying the streak, so I'm going to keep the streak going by just keeping the conditions going, just for my own interest, seeing how far I can take this, which I think is on the broadcast end of the spectrum in a way. It's like, how far can I push this weird mathematical anomaly, right? Like, I've broken the 50% win-loss ratio, so how long can I keep that going? This person interpreted me saying, I'm not going to let myself play a different character until I've lost one, because then, as I'm punishing myself in a way. You know what I mean? Like, if I want to go and try something, because obviously I know that if I change character, my win rate, my chance of winning goes down because I'm less experienced. And so but that viewpoint, the viewpoint of why you punish yourself, assumes that I want the game to be there to entertain me, you know what I mean? To kind of fill my whim to play a different character or whatever, whereas I'm kind of like engaging. I think broadcast and give and receive is one way of putting it.
Hmm.
A different way of putting it is probably, whether you are kind of like engaging with the game, or sort of, I guess, letting the game take you somewhere, or demanding that you take where, you know what I mean, the game comes where you want to go.
Mm.
So I would say that in that context, the analogy is the kind of, I'm playing this for fun, I want you to provide me with fun, is the game has to come to me.
Yeah.
Whereas, I'm gonna see how long I can keep this weird win streak going by playing according to the circumstances that the game is kind of telling me what to do.
Right.
Is me going with the game. Sure. And I am way far on the go with the game side of the spectrum, which filters into, like, my opinion of RPGs. Like, you know, my approach to Dragon Age is, you have to give the game the benefit of the doubt and invest imaginatively in it, and you can't criticize it if you're not willing to give. Whereas I get the viewpoint of people who are like, no, this was bullshit, because it allowed me to make a dwarf with a big green mustache, and then it wasn't immersive.
Yeah, I see that. I mean, RPGs are interesting, because I think I fall somewhere in the middle of the spectrum, but when it comes to competitive games, I'm way on the feed me end of it. And it's stuff like leaderboards and stuff like that, I never feel the pull towards leaderboards, because I don't seek, it's just a meaningless validation, you know, like, I wouldn't understand why that would be valuable to be on a leaderboard.
Is that even the case with friends leaderboards?
Hmm?
Is that even the case with friends leaderboards?
No, I mean, I still feel the pull of competition between individuals and between people, but I wouldn't ever choose a game, usually, to be the battleground of that competition. Like, it just seems kind of absurd to me.
Although real fighting, that's Marsh's way.
No. I still feel competitive. I don't actually like that feeling anyway, but, you know, I'd want to be competitive in something else other than games, because unless I'm really enjoying the game as a completely separate experience from the competition would never be the reason for me to play a game, I don't think. But anyway, going back to Heart of the Storm, is it called Heart? Heroes of the Storm. Yeah. Fucking hell, Blizzard, you idiots.
Do you know, I've told this story on the podcast before, but you know why they changed it from Blizzard All-Stars?
Because they're idiots?
No, because internally it had become known as Balls.
Oh, that's right, yes.
Because the natural acronym for that was Balls, and so they changed it to an acronym they already had.
But it's interesting, because I have played competitive games, I played multiplayer games a lot, especially when I was at university, but the only way I was able to enjoy them was when I was playing as a team, in co-op, essentially, against nameless opposition. I never thought of the people I was playing against as real human beings. They're just really good bots. And it's weird how exactly HOTS feels like Halo to me, even though they're completely different genres, but the camaraderie and the cooperation feel almost exactly the same. Especially when I'm playing with Rich Stanton and Owen Hill, and, who are my Halo buddies of yore. And it feels great playing it again. And everything, you know, just to go back to the complexity issue, I really like the fact that I can see the skill ceiling. You know, that's not possible in Dota. As soon as you start going through the tutorial, you're just like, okay, here's stuff that I will not understand for 20 hours, maybe several thousand hours. And yet, even within the first few hours of Heroes of the Storm, I understand the context in which all of the information is being given to me. I understand, and you know, it would probably take me 15 hours, I think, to have a really good grasp of all of its systems. And I may never be good at it, but at least I know the world in which it's being played. In the same way that I understand how Counter-Strike is played at a high level, even if I'm completely incapable of emulating it. But when I look at a Dota match, there's no chance of me ever understanding it. And I don't really want to. Like, I'm happy with my 15-hour engagement with the game.
I think, though, for a game like Dota, it's in its best interests to present this astonishing, massive skill tree that people are clawing their way up endlessly, because, you know, they'll want people to be playing that forever. It's their go-to game, you know. Then if I was Blizzard, I'd be slightly worried that...
Well, actually, I was reading an interview today which addresses this. Mm. It was one by, interview with Christian Dolan on Eurogamer, and he was talking about how its gimmicks are going to go stale, essentially, to Dustin Browder. Is it Browder?
It's Browder.
And he was saying, well, you know, if something goes stale, we'll throw it out and make a new gimmick. Mm. And it seems like they're not attempting to have an endless skill ceiling, they're attempting to have an endless gimmick ceiling.
It's just maps.
Yeah.
Maps that gives currency.
And that's kind of fine, actually. That really works. That does, you know, I'm thinking, actually, now that maybe I will play it for more than 15 hours, if the game continues to be just surprising and dynamic and, you know, silly. And it is really silly.
The reason I play that is because you can be a siege tank. That will be my first port of call.
Be prepared to pay for that.
It's hard.
No, but it's expensive.
Oh, really?
It's not that expensive. I've been looking into the prices now, and you do earn gold at quite a prestigious rate if you do all the quests. I don't know if when you were playing it, they even had quests in there.
They do, yeah.
Oh, right, okay. But
it's still... on the business model thing, I mean, that's my major, I mean, it's not quite in an earlier part of the alpha, it was far more egregious. Like, there were account upgrades, similar to League of Legends. I know there's a listener, Avogad, who's probably annoyed at me for banging on about this again, but, I hate that notion. I hate the notion that an account linked thing makes you better in the game. Mm. Because even if you can earn it through the game, I kind of want it to be a level playing field based on, you know, purely on skill, especially with a game like this. I do have concerns that the characters are pretty expensive for what they amount to. £3 to £10 for a character, which is one character, and the characters are also relatively simple.
I think I'm probably going to be able to, if I keep playing at the same rate, which is not like a hardcore nose to the grindstone sort of thing, I'd be able to unlock a character a week easily, I imagine. And they're not that many characters.
No, I mean, and so,
you have to learn them as well, so it's not...
Yeah, so there is that, you can unlock them, but they are a variable price as well, so, whereas, you know, a character that's been out since the beginning of the alpha might cost you 2,000 gold, which is pretty achievable. Mm. If you want Thrall, the latest one, he's 10,000.
Oh, so they vary it based on...
Newness.
Reasons,
right? It's the same, it's exactly the same as League of Legends.
Okay.
And I guess, and I get it, I get that you can unlock things. I also get that because it's a game that doesn't demand the same, doesn't need to be your life.
Hmm.
Maybe your one character is enough for you. You buy the siege tank, you pay your £6, and that's you done.
Hmm. I don't think unless you're playing it pro, and I don't know if it's ever going to develop a pro scene the same way Dota does.
People already are trying.
But then, if it doesn't make that, that's kind of fine. You know,
I agree.
You know, I just don't think anybody's going to really feel the need to be like a generalist and know all the characters necessarily to the same extent.
Apart from the one specific way which the game directly encourages that, which is Hero League, which is its equivalent of Ranked.
Okay.
And something I learned, this was actually new to me, because Ranked in any of these games is just the mode where you get given a visible rank that, you know, shows you your skill level relative to other players, whatever form that takes. Dota doesn't use this system, but Smite and League of Legends both do, where playing Ranked requires you to level your account up to at a certain point. I think that's presumably to prevent smurfing, just, you know, creating new accounts constantly. And it also needs you to own a certain number of characters. And so obviously Dota can't have that because everyone has all the characters anyway. Yeah. Smite gets around it, I would argue, by having the option to buy, pay a one-off fee to get all the characters forever, including new characters.
That's good for me. That's what I want.
Yeah, it's like 30 quid game price, and you have 62 characters currently, and however many they go on to add. League and Hearts both require you to continually buy characters, and they might do bundle packs, but it's always going to be more stuff.
Yeah.
There's actually on our forums, someone in I think the discussion thread from the previous episode, figured out that to unlock everything in League of Legends, including all the summoner upgrades and everything else, playing three games a day would take 5 years, or cost £500.
Whoa!
And Hots isn't there yet because there aren't that many characters, and there are bundles and stuff available. I worked out that to play, in addition to leveling your account to 30, which I assume would get you probably about 4 or 5 characters, I think tops. Mm. You'd probably need to spend 20 to 30 quid on top of that to then play ranked, because it requires you to own 10. So it's still quite steep. And that's really off-putting for me, because ranked is my goal. Like, you know, that's what I want. Like, I want access to those stats about my performance. I want access to that kind of tangible progress through a competitive system.
I just want to wreck noobs with my friends.
Yeah, and I totally get that. Because we were playing it the other day, and I was
getting... We were getting wrecked, actually.
We were getting wrecked. And I actually... The frustrating thing about that experience was, I think... So this is one thing that I think the game has in common with Dota, and it's exactly the same thing, but for almost different reasons. Both games, you have to play them in a party.
Mm.
And in Dota's case, your party is your self-help group. Right, it's because it's so enormously complicated when you're first starting out that you need other human beings to relate to as you go about climbing this vertical learning curve. You need to, and you know, the experience is enhanced by discovering things together. You know, your first 200 hours of that game are spent going, "What the fuck is that?" And that feeling is more enjoyable if you're all in the boat together. So it is that experience of going on like an Arctic expedition, right? It's mutual suffering is what kind of makes that fun, because if you know, suffering alone is awful. But, you know, "Why am I a pig?" is a great thing to experience with a friend. Whereas with Hots, the reason you play it with other people is so that you can exert some control over its simplicity. Because otherwise, it's mega frustrating. You know, we were playing it, and I've got a decent sense now for how the game is won. But because the skill cap is quite low, one player can only do so much to shift a game. It's not like Dota, where one person can get massively ahead and just carry their team, which is what's expected of people in solo ranked. If you want to get better, you just, same as Smite, just get used to being the guy that wins the game for everybody else. Like, you can't really do that in Hots. It requires, enforces collaboration by evening everybody out. Similarly, two people struggle to shift the balance of a game. We have moments where we're like, you know, they're about to go to the mines and take all of the skulls. We need to go and maybe take another objective just to force this lane out, or, you know, do something to prepare the side. But our team aren't communicating with us. They're not responding to the radial wheel. They're not, you know, they're not, when we ping something, they don't give a shit. They're just doing their own thing. They're basically just big neutrals that we can't control. So our game is quite frustrating, because it's like, we know where this needs to happen, but we can't exert any... The pieces in the box are still just doing whatever the fuck they want, so it's just like...
And a third person, though, and it does tip over, right?
I think it's when you tip over into the more than half of the team is humans that you trust, then it works. I mean, and admittedly, I haven't played it like that, and I think I would really enjoy it, you know, playing it with a group where I can say, hey, you know, I can use a little bit of that dose knowledge to go, this is what we do, we force a reaction here, then we do this.
Yeah.
But, you know, because you were saying, Chris, just tell me what to do, and it's like, at the... To be honest, me telling you what to do is not going to make any difference. Because the problem is not you, it's the three people just doing whatever the fuck they want.
It's interesting. This chimes with some stuff when I was talking to them at BlizzCon about Overwatch, which is going to be their 5v5 arena shooter thing. They were talking about how they didn't want to give any one player too much responsibility, because they felt that it would put too much pressure on people to perform in ways that would alienate casual players. And it feels like the similar thing has happened in Heart of the Swarm, but they dare not give people too much power.
I think one of the weaknesses of that is it gives people nothing to aspire to. Like, you know, I mean, as awful as player hierarchies can be, and as awful as the behaviour can be, I've seen some really shitty behaviour in Hots. People still blame each other, even though it does a lot to level out. Like, even to the extent that individual players don't get kills, teams get kills. Even stuff like that, which prevents people from saying explicitly, like, oh, I... Like, it kind of merges kills and assists into takedowns.
Yeah.
So you might all have the same takedown stat if you've all been in the same fights.
Mm-hmm.
And it levels that up. People still blame each other. They still get angry. Yeah, they're still like, why are you feeding? Why are you coming and helping me? You know, it doesn't... But what you don't have is the one guy, when you're in a game and you're behind, but he saves you, and that guy gets you through the game, and you go, all right, I'm going to be like that guy. Hmm. Likewise, you know, you don't, like...
It's probably hard to identify. I suppose if you're one of the two players on a team who is shit and the other three people are carrying it for you, you probably aren't going to be able to identify why it is that you're doing well.
Okay.
Learning Smite at the moment, which I'm really enjoying, a lot of it is playing support, because people never want to play support.
Hmm.
And just quietly delivering victory to people by refusing to get the kills, but setting up all the kills. And the best example of this is a character I just started playing today for the first time, who's Sobek, the Egyptian god of the Nile, who's like an alligator man with an axe. His model is awful. He looks like a kind of Unity Store asset. It's really weird. But or like an over-rendered Unreal Engine Mario villain. It's kind of, I don't know where they were going with him. But one of his abilities is he charges forwards, and if he connects with, he does damage to minions, but if he connects with an enemy player, he stuns them and throws them backwards over his head, which is, it can be used as an escape just to get away from people. But I was playing the arena mode, which is the big brawl, and just treating it like my only job is to throw people, the rest of my team to eat. And like, I'm just a waiter, right? Like, my job, and it was really fun. I didn't get any kills in that game. I just ran at people, threw them into my team, and was like, go guys, cause I'll trust you to do exactly that, right? Like, if, you know, one of the guys in the enemy team was Hunbats, who's a Mayan monkey god. And it's like, who wants a monkey? and then you know, you see the sea lions behind me, just like, and then you know, it's killed. I'm not going to say it's entirely on me, because they're pulling off those fights and they're positioned to receive it. But you know, in that game, it's like, I want to win this, and I know I can help us win by just playing selflessly for a game and just doing the thing no one else wants to do and setting up the kills. And it's fun for me as well, and I get a win out of it. That really doesn't happen in HOTS, because there's no real selflessness in it. It's like everyone's sort of even. So,
I don't know why. You can create builds of characters that are essentially just feeding the rest of your team kills.
Well, you can be a healer or something, I suppose. Yeah, like there's, but like,
well, no,
it doesn't feel as essential in some way. Like you have the guy like, as well.
There's a bunch of characters. I'm Stitches and ETC are two, and I'm sure you'd know who the others are that are simply designed to pull other characters out of team fights and isolate them and give them to the rest of your team.
Well, Stitches pulls people to himself. He's the puncher.
Yeah, and with ETC, you flip to the other side of them and kind of punt them back at your character.
Yeah, I suppose there is that. But the emphasis on those characters is still playmaking. It's still...
Yeah.
I mean, like... I don't know, it doesn't feel quite the same, only because that still counts as a kill for both people involved.
Yeah.
Like, it's not...
But that's why it's good. That's why it's better.
And here we hit the core kind of difference in interpretation of these systems.
Yeah. I mean, the difference in interpretation of systems is when it breaks down to, like, why that kill is important. Because, you know, in Heroes of the Storm, it's just XP for everybody.
Yeah.
And in a game like Dota or Smite or LoL, it's you have to direct where that resource goes, and that requires someone to give something up.
Yeah.
Right? And that's where strategy comes from. I'm not saying the game doesn't have it. I'm just saying that I think creates a flatness that if you don't have a team, basically, because if you're playing with a big group of people, you will naturally make those sacrifices for each other, right?
Yeah.
In Melee, playing solo, I guess what I'm talking about is the solo experience.
Right.
And like, if you're playing solo,
so I never play solo anyway, for the aforementioned reason that I...
yeah, and that's fair. Like, but if you're playing solo, there's no way to kind of meaningfully influence the gamers. That's ultimately what I'm saying. Like, in a game like Smite or Dota, you can be the guy that takes on the selfless jobs to make sure your team wins. Because you have a disproportionate influence on the game if you do that. Because of the way Heroes evens everyone out, there's no way to have a disproportionate influence on the game, really. And that means if you're with people, that means your experience is more at the mercy of who matchmaking bonks you with. That's, I guess, what I'm getting at.
Do you think that it'll find an audience, Marsh? Do you think it'll find its little crowd of happy...
Yeah, no, I do think it will. There's a lot of people out there who probably never touched a MOBA before who would fall into it. But also, I was really reluctant to play it because I find Blizzard's games just to be extremely anodyne in their presentation, and their fiction is just so fucking banal and dumb. And, you know, it's the idea that these are their heroes, their most memorable characters, you know, the one who has a hammer.
What about the siege tank, Marsh? The immortal siege tank?
No, the siege tank is actually one of the most characterful creatures in the game. And yet, Blizzard clearly know that their characters are a bunch of shit, because the skins for them are just ridiculous. Mm. So you have, like, I guess it's some kind of creature from the Swarm in StarCraft, this big gelatinous, horrible maggot thing with tendrils. And you can get a skin which turns it into a little baby with a little baby hat and a little little sucker.
Yeah.
And then when it goes in, I think it goes into some kind of hibernation mode where it sends out remote control things. And it just turns into a crib when you've got that skin. It's fucking brilliant.
No, that's awesome.
Owen has who plays Brightwing most of the time, which is kind of this lizardy fairy thing. He's got a skin for it which turns it into a flying monkey with a fez. It is the most Owen skin.
That sounds like Owen. Yeah.
Interestingly, that I interviewed Sam Didier, who's Blizzard's long-time art director, about exactly that, the skins. Mm. And they take it very seriously.
Oh, really?
It's a process of internal, like, you know, they have fun with it as well, because it's an opportunity to play with those characters. But no, they take their characters really seriously.
They're idiots, as I said before.
You said. I did say.
I think Blizzard, they kind of know what they're doing with those characters. Though they're like, I've described it as like shaving the edges off archetypes and making them as appealing to as many people as possible. Like Blizzard games are just these things that achieve mainstream success because they don't really offend anyone ever. And having just all your characters, as you say, you'd say anodyne, and it is, but at the same time, no one's going to look at it and say that's not for me because it's people see it's kind of fun and lighthearted.
There's something about Heroes' menus that's really fucking clickable.
They're good at that.
I had to load them today to fact check something in the magazine, and I almost played a game. I'm on deadline. I don't have time for that. I don't want to. I don't even want to. It's just like, God, that button's really purple.
Yeah, that's why I play Diablo. It's because they're good at that. That's all.
Just briefly, I've also played another game, which I don't want to talk about particularly very long, but it's Armello, which is like a digitalised board game. It never really existed as a board game. It existed as a paper prototype, and then they turned it into a really horrendously complicated paper prototype that they managed to turn into a digital game. It's in early access at the moment. But it has, again, it's got some kind of fucking Blizzard magic with the kind of tactile stuff, because they've got all these cards. The cards feel really lovely and papery, and they have weight, and you move them around the screen like you would move real cards, and they chunk into menus on the left, and you can drop them like a plop onto the kind of your inventory screen. And they're all animated as well, really subtly. So they're kind of this beautiful art in these kind of little boxes within the cards. And then, you know, you've got a rat stabbing somebody in the thigh or something, so, you know, just gently shivving them over and over again. And then, you know, just everything looks really beautiful, and it's got dice that feel really tactile. Rattle across a wooden board sound when you physics enabled dice. Lots of problems with the game. Mm. I've written about it for RPS. You should read that probably.
Put it in the show notes. Yeah. Menus, eh?
Should we do questions from questions?
Funny you should ask, Marsh, because I've got a handful of questions right here from our lovely listeners. The first one is Joel. Says, "Hello, great and wonderbar. So, I was thinking of ordering a t-shirt featuring Gandalf's hot nozzle, but then I realised that I'd also like to hide my chest behind some more recent episode titles. Is it possible to persuade Marsh to create some new ones in exchange for whiskey money? I'll pay $top/pound for crossing the number Wang event horizon," which is the title of an earlier episode. Yeah. How would you draw that, Marsh, crossing the number Wang event horizon? That's quite abstract.
Well, it'd just be a poster for fantastic Sam Neill movie, but with David Mitchell's face.
I can do that. You can do that.
Keep bathing, Joel insists. P.S. I just assumed Marsh was the artist. After watching Tom Atkins' Game Maker tutorial, I realised I'd also probably pay him to draw some t-shirts too.
Well, we'll ask him and see.
He's got what he says. Yeah.
I like that there's literally a t-shirt which involves Gandalf's pendulous knob as a hose pipe in a ring of flame. And you think that might not have been Marsh.
It's the most Marsh image.
I do intend to do more and many more t-shirts, but they aren't very lucrative, frankly. So yes, I have not really put my head to the grindstone and done it yet, but maybe I will. Who knows?
Shall we tell listeners where they can get t-shirts if they maybe don't know that this is a thing that exists?
Yeah, I can't remember the URL, but you can go to our own website, CraneCrowbar.com, and there is a link to t-shirts from that page, and you can get all kinds of slightly salacious things and pictures of ducks,
odd nozzles,
owls
more.
And ducks,
owls, there's good
ducks,
ones,
nozzles, yeah. All the major food groups there.
I know you've eaten a lot of them.
David Moore asks, or says, "Dearest Creighton Crowbar, you have mentioned Diablo 3 is a good example of RPG progression done right. I'm still pretty new to D3. I bought it last week based on your endorsement." Nervous now. "But I have a great deal of experience with Path of Exile. PoE is billed by many old-school D2 fans as being the spiritual successor to Diablo 2, usually immediately prior to questioning the parentage of anyone who works for Blizzard. Path of Exile is a game in which it's incredibly easy to make an unplayable character by making reasonable-seeming decisions about character progression. There are 1,325 nodes in their skill tree." This is true, I can attest to this. "Which is actually a skill web. I don't find that I favour one game over the other at this stage. Have you played Path of Exile? How do you feel about it in comparison to Diablo 3? I reviewed Path of Exile, and it's very, very good at for Diablo 2 fans, and for people who love old-fashioned, kind of nitty-gritty RPG systems that require you to very slowly gain a knowledge and understanding of something that is initially encyclopedic. And kind of a lot of the pleasure of it is becoming an expert and, you know, just knowing the right way to go on the skill tree. And the progression system of Path of Exile is fantastic because it's, as you said, it's a web of 1,325 nodes, which are basically skill nodes that you can jump between as your character levels, and they unlock like incremental stat bonuses, like a bit of extra dexterity here, a bit of extra strength there, and occasionally an ability. And this lets you craft your character by going in any direction you want. And there's, after playing a few times, you unlock the hardest character class, which starts in the middle, where, you know, you have to know the skill tree inside out. You have to know those 1,325 nodes, like the back of your hand, before you attempt this kind of this character is in the middle. Because if you go in the wrong direction, you could just fuck yourself and create a character that just isn't viable in the late game. And it'll take you quite 20 hours to find out as well.
Can this you be spec?
I think you can. I mean, David, if you write in and tell me I'm wrong, then that's fair enough, because it's a couple of years since I reviewed it. But I think you can, but at the same time, it's expensive and not really expected of you. Like, the game expects you to figure this shit out. And if you make a mistake, then you fucked up and it's your fault. And that's the consequence of making wrong decisions. So that basically gives your choices the weight that they have. I basically, having played Diablo 3 now, disagree with that system a little bit because it locks off fun. Just every time you make a decision about where you go in the skill web, you're locking off fun for yourself somehow. You're throwing away a direction your character could go in. Whereas in Diablo 3, every time you unlock something, you unlock opportunity and the, you know, further experimentation. However, I really enjoyed Path of Exile. It really, if you love Diablo 2, then that should be your next port of call, because it's a free-to-play game with incredibly generous free-to-play mechanics as well. Or anything you pay for is cosmetics. And for an economy based entirely around gems and skill nodes, for them to not monetize that is just fantastic. Like, if I put that in front of an EA executive with the, you know, all the crystals that you can buy and the incremental upgrades you can get, then it would destroy the game and it would be a horrible money sink. But as it is, they've designed it so that the progression systems are completely separate from the monetization systems. So it's basically, that gives it its weight and quality as an RPG. And yeah, that's good. Don't play it if you don't like the idea of wading into 1,325 nodes, though.
Say no to nodes.
Ian writes, "Dear Creighton, murder of crowbars, I was interested to hear your discussion of Second Life in episode 75, and specifically whether various community actions within the game were a good thing for raising debate, or if having that closed loop for things like paedophilia was beyond the pale. It struck me as particularly relevant in light of the recent tragic events in Paris. I like to think of myself as a free speech advocate who believes that we have the right to say and print whatever you like, and that doesn't mean you should. Are there any games you think overstep the mark of what is acceptable? And if a game developer designed something that you had you playing as the Prophet Muhammad, for example, would that be a legitimate enterprise in wider discourse or just crassly offensive? Keep writing and podcasting all, Ian."
I think you can be crassly offensive, isn't that the like, there's no reason not to be crassly offensive apart from the sense, you know, being a decent human being and understanding the sensitivity of your fellow man. There's no, you know, that question supposes that being crassly offensive is something that should be forbidden in some way.
I think he's, I'm not sure he's proposing that. I think he's just kind of poking us and asking us whether.
Oh, yeah, sure, yeah.
We think that.
I think games are people don't really know how to judge games in this regard. Like, like a lot of new mediums, they're exposed to more scrutiny in terms of their intentions in some ways. But equally, people don't really know how to judge an interactive medium, where what a message exactly is when it's coming from a game. You know, there are absolutely, as with any other medium, opportunities to depict whatever you want, well or badly, in the context of a game. However, I don't know, either the press is still naive enough or the medium is still young enough for what one game does to be taken as somehow meaningful to what other games do.
Mm.
That is probably the thing that, I don't know if we discussed it already, but that's probably the issue that will surround Hatred when it finally comes out. You know, it's caused a lot of controversy already. This, if you're not aware, is the kind of isometric postal style, you know, social revenge porn shooter thing being made by developers that's actively courting kind of controversy at the moment. That stuff, like, it's probably going to be shit. Because Postal was shit. Because most games that are made with that intent are shit. Because they're kind of bad faith creations from the outset that are just there to be shouted down by red top newspapers and ultimately sell a bunch and then forgotten forever. It doesn't mean that it would not be possible for a developer to make an interesting or provocative or offensive or challenging game using some of the same themes and claim some artistic legitimacy for that. It just means that those people might be shite hawks at the end of the day.
I mean, there's the, regarding the depictions of Prophet Muhammad in Paris, that stuff, like, there's been a huge amount of hypocrisy around that, in which, you know, authorities ban things around depictions of Jesus all the time, like, or they're repressed in some way. There was Jesus Christ, the Jesus...
Piss Christ, I think you're talking
about. Piss Christ, is that right?
The piece of art.
Yes, that's right. And but even... a kind of mob rule reaction to the opera that Stuart Lee wrote back in like years ago, where it was shown in Birmingham. I think it was shown somewhere where it was basically just the mob stopped them from showing it. The theatre shut it down and they got rid of it. Like these things are shut down by the mob. I personally think that distasteful things will always find you just with the internet here. You can put distasteful things anywhere, and it's up to people to publicly debate why it's distasteful and instill a sense of duty in everyone not to pointlessly offend each other for no reason. But I don't know, it's a huge issue.
I suppose, I mean, you know, to take it, I mean, obviously the Paris stuff is so evocative that I don't really feel mega comfortable, kind of, like, because obviously there's been lots of questionable decisions made regarding free speech in France since, you know, kids that have been arrested for showing, you know, strong views in favour of, you know, free speech for Muslims, for example, but I don't understand enough about the issue to go into it to that degree. What I would say is that the ideal is that everybody is mature enough to deal with being offended in a way that they recognize that in being offended by something, they're actually experiencing a right that they also have being exercised. You know, that someone else's use of their free speech does not impinge on your own free speech. But that is the emotional reflex that never fucking happens. What happens every time is, this person has offended me, what legal recourse do I have? What authority can I appeal to have this person's work taken away, discredited, shut down, whatever? Like, if you want a single motivating factor for Gamergate, it's that. It's, I didn't like this article. I don't like this website. What paradigm, philosophical principle or actual legal recourse can I find to turn my not liking something into something that I personally can get some kind of tangible revenge for? Like, it's the selflessness to say, I was offended by this, but I respect someone else's right to say it, is really rare, and even rarer in crowds. And it's, you know...
Do you think that exposure would... Like, a lot of the reasons these things cause offence is because they're so risky that people very rarely pursue those images or pursue offending people in that particular way. Do you think it was just a thing that communities just had to deal with because it was out there all the time? Do you think that would mediate things?
I think...
I don't know, especially... It's hard to say. And the issue with the depiction of Muhammad, or at least one of the arguments made about why reprinting the pictures might be not just offensive, but actually wrong in some greater sense, because... Muslims in France are already considered like an oppressed minority, and so to further subject them to some sort of ridicule would seem to be not simply not simply to expose whatever hypocrisy is endemic in their culture, but it would also be a further act of oppression against the people who are already marginalised. And like, it's impossible to separate those two, that one action into those two bits, I think. I don't know.
So
the thing he's referring to in a previous episode, when we were talking about Second Life and Second Life having groups of people who indulge in age play, as they call it, which is essentially, I suppose it's paedophilia, but expressed through digital means.
Well, it's adults creating a fantasy environment in which there are underage people, like.
Which is complicated by the virtual nature of the reality, where that stuff could be more literal than it would be in real
life. That's very different from an instance where offence is being caused, because I'm not, although I am offended by that, offence isn't the reason that I would ever take issue with it. It's because I think there is a nascent criminal act being encouraged there, in the same way that you differentiate in law between offensive speech and hate speech and incitement to violence and things like that. And I think if you create a community which is inciting or in some way encouraging stuff that is in society considered criminal, then I think that's more problematic than simply doing something which is going to upset people.
I think the only thing to add on this that I'd say is I think games, more than a lot of mediums, actively anonymize the people who create the games, or frame their creators in a really different way. Just on the surface, in terms of people's immediate reaction to them, to other forms of media. If you read a column that offends you, this is a pretty facile example, but you have an immediate sense of who the person who wrote it was. There's a byline or a photo or something like that. Likewise, a speech. Likewise, a movie, even, if there are actors voicing viewpoints that you don't agree with. Something of the kind of, like, created by a human nature of the thing is really visible in most forms of media, or is foregrounded in some way, whereas games traditionally, traditionally, I would stress, are the product of studios, where the individual creators are fairly anonymous anyway, because they tend to be really collective works. Second, games give the sense to the player that the game itself has some kind of agency, right? Like, you get annoyed at the game, and maybe via the game you get annoyed at your idea of what the developer's like, but your engagement with, like, where does this offensive message come from in a game is, I think, abstracted by the medium. And in a way, that's a big problem. Like, one way to make offensive games more acceptable is to foreground the people making the decisions that might cause offence. Right.
Right. So you're saying it's difficult for games to make statements because there's no agency identified behind
them? I'm saying that games make, like, the process of knowing who to criticize, knowing how to reconcile an offense, is harder with games because they naturally obscure the creative minds that might make that decision, unless those creative people are actively putting themselves in front of you. Whereas other mediums,
developers get a lot of hate.
developers get hate in abstract a lot of the time. Or, like, you know, if you think about, I'm thinking about, like, if you think about the most provocative Twine games you can imagine, like, you know, stuff that has real serious, angry stuff to say about sexuality or gender or whatever, some of that stuff could be offensive or whatever, could be provocative, could be graphic or unsettling, but in almost every case, as with most art scenes in everything ever, those are auteur creations. You know exactly who's made them. It's a new game by somebody you know, and therefore that provides a context for you as an appreciator of that thing that helps you, you know, if your initial response is to recoil from it, it helps you reconcile that with the thing. Whereas a game coming from a studio that kind of blunders into some social issues or whatever, the purposefulness or not of those issues is, I would say, obfuscated by the nature of the medium.
It's kind of diluted because there's no one person making decisions anyway. In terms of whether there is a game that has existed which is beyond the pale, I mean, obviously that presupposes that there is a pale beyond which some kind of other reaction must be demanded. I don't think there is. I think, you know, you can say anything and you should be rightly criticised for being gross or disgusting, but I don't know that that would necessarily require censorship. But What games have offended you then? What games have deeply, deeply offended you? I think one of the Saints Rows deeply offended me.
Really?
Yeah, presentation of sex traffic I thought was was utterly grotesque. So grotesque that I thought about quitting games journalism.
Really?
Yeah, so I had to go for a long walk.
Did you write an angry letter to...
No, I wrote a bit of a stinking review. Yeah. But yeah.
I don't think I've ever been offended that deeply by a game, to be honest. I think, like, games are so kind of dumb most of the time that to feel offended on a, such a fundamental level would be ridiculous. I'd recognise that there's, like, perhaps stupidity in the people who have written and constructed this thing.
It was thoughtlessness. That was the that was the thing that offended me about it. It wasn't that I thought that they had they were mocking sex slavery or anything like that. They just used it as a backdrop to use their scantily clad female model again. And was one of the things that really annoyed me in the review. Actually, got edited. I don't know for what reason, but I'd said that the models were put in there for pure titillation. Sorry, that it was used as a backdrop for the purpose of titillation. Like, that's all that they thought about was, well, we want to use these scantily clad women models again. Why would they be on this boat? They'll be in containers because they're sex slaves. You're saving them to be sex slaves. And then you actually re-enslave them, which is really grotty. They got changed to shock value, which is exactly the opposite of what I meant, because the people making the game had no idea about the context in which they were operating. They weren't trying to make any point. They were just being thick shits. You know? That was one of the most... I think a few times I've been really irritated by being edited.
The one that still bothers me, and I think the key thing is kind of the core of the question is, I can say, this really bothers me without implying ban this. Is... new Mortal Kombat. Like, I find it hard to watch the trailers for the new one, because every trailer shows off a new fatality. That's kind of like what they're getting at now with their marketing things. It's like, here are some new characters, and at the end you're going to see the really gross stuff. And I actually liked Mortal Kombat 9 as a fighting game, but ended up playing a lot more of Injustice, because Injustice used DC superheroes, therefore its finishing moves were really silly and not very bloody. And it was basically the same game in a lot of ways, so I could enjoy that, but there was so much that was, I mean, partly just sickeningly gross about, Mortal Kombat 9. The new one was worse. Like, they've had to escalate it. In terms of just nasty shit, right? Like, really gross dismemberments and like, guttings and stuff. But also, it was so explicitly, there was a game in the 80s, I think it was, classical fighting game that had decapitation. It's one of the first games with dismemberment in it. And the original Mortal Kombat was kind of that. It was like, look what gross stuff we can do with these photo reference sprites. You know what I mean? But it was still that kind of, to the degree that it obviously had caused a fuss at the time, but really it was kind of like, you know, we can't push this technology as far as we can possibly get it to go. And there's no sort of limits on what they can do now if they want to make something gross, right? Like, that technological race has kind of been taken away from it. So partly it's a legacy thing, but also, it's so out of key with, like, the content of the rest of the game. Like, the regular fights are people kicking, seven shades of shit out of each other with, you know, swords and bladed hats and you know, knives and stuff. And obviously there's blood and occasionally, like, femur shattering in the new one. But that's not something that really bothers me. What bothers me is the bit at the end where you still dial in the button combination to see the schlocky gore porn. And it just feels like, I know it's part of the series, but it sort of feels just obnoxious and kind of really egregious. And if you have it happen to you, because it requires direct will on part of the other player, for example, if you're playing online or against somebody on the couch, it requires the other person to want to make you sit through a cutscene that's really sickening. And, like, the whole thing is just gross. Like, I'd kind of happily remove it, and I know that would make it no longer a Mortal Kombat game, but the new one, I just, no.
I guess fundamentally, we'd agree that those things should still come out and then be publicly condemned for their,
Sure.
Unless they're inciting violence or committing some kind of crime, then.
Yeah.
Well, I guess I would say that's really, and that's such a weird grey area that's, you know, because things don't exist in a vacuum. And in a world where you know, there has been a significant shooting in the US by an alienated young man, or in Germany last year or the year before. Like, pretty much, they happen every year, even several times a year. Is it then deeply, deeply irresponsible to make a game about that subject matter? I don't know. Because, on one hand, you could say that's directly encouraging it. You could move that, shunt that into the, into, you could shunt hatred into hate speech.
Yeah, I know there's, I mean, you could make the same case for GTA's kind of, more chaotic moments, I imagine. I mean, that's a game which you can fulfill your fantasies of wrecking a city.
Yeah.
I know, it would be interesting to have, like an academic exploration of why that is semiotically different from hatred, because obviously lots of people have played GTA and I enjoy wrecking stuff in GTA, and yet I have a very visceral, different reaction to hatred from that. And I'm not quite sure why that is. And
so it's because it's tapping into visually to the videos that those kids make before they go out and kill people. The image of the protagonist, like, they're directly referencing those.
It's intent as well.
Yeah. It's, I mean, intent is a tricky thing in terms of criticism, but I think it's actually a lot to do with marketing as well. Like, Rockstar have been very careful with GTA. They never advertise it as Murdertron 5000.
Yeah.
Right? Like, ever. Like, I mean, their advertising is maybe misleading in a different way. It's like, this is going to be some kind of cool film experience, right? They kind of want their trailers to look like Scorsese movie trailers, or, you know what I mean? They want to look like crime films or something like that.
Do you think one of the reasons that they've continued to pursue the cinematic angle on their games is so that they've been able to distance themselves from the stuff that players actually do in them?
Maybe. I mean, I was sort of thinking along those lines myself, but it's like, I think even if you don't, they definitely have their own artistic aspirations for those games, whether you like them or not.
Hmm.
And taking away the cynical, we're just masking the murder thing from that, they have something that they want to tell with that game that is sort of separate from the freedom the game affords you. The advertising message for something like Hatred is entirely, this is what you get to do in this game. You know what I mean? The recent thing was like, if we get to this point in our alpha, we'll unlock the ability to go and kill SJWs and stuff like that. Like, they're referencing real events. They're encouraging people to kind of, like, live out those fantasies. And without getting bogged down in, can games actually make people go out and do things? That's not relevant. What's relevant is the marketing behind the game is driven by exactly that feeling. You know, it's like, if GTA was marketed as get your revenge on society, then it would be a completely different product. It's not, because it's, you know, marketed with this cool soundtrack and, like, serious dudes talking about their serious lives in a kind of funny, bantery way. Like, it is about, it's not just about intent, it's about who the game thinks the player is. You know, film fan or...
Actually, in GTA's defense, and this is maybe going back to the idea of me wanting to be fed by games and then express myself through them, but... over subsequent GTA games, I've become less and less inclined to go on rampages and the last game, I pretty much acted like a good civilian outside of these missions, which forced me to kill bunches of dudes.
I've gotten more uncomfortable with GTA as time's gone on, because I've gotten older, my sensibilities have changed, but also the games themselves have kind of changed in their focus. Like, I loved Vice City, because it was Scarface, and it was, you know, it was like, this world isn't real, it's like cartoon 80s Miami, and they can gun down people because, like, you know, the whole game sort of takes place in the brain of a coked out drug lord, and that's kind of like where you are. Similarly, Saints Row, I don't really feel bad about, you know, I mean, I think, I know I've played the mission you have, and I kind of agree that that's just a total tonal misstep for them, given how well they've done in other regards. Saints Row, you know, got to the point where it's like, guess what, this is actually a computer simulation. So you don't have to give two shits about running people over. Just have fun, you know? Like, it kind of distances itself from it in a different way. GTA, I found myself now just thinking, I don't really want to be these people. I want to play in that game world as the fucking Euro Truck Simulator guy.
Yeah. Go skydiving on drugs. Do some biking and across the hills.
It'd be a harmless drug addict. Like,
is GTA affords you the freedom to play that way if you really want to.
Play
golf and play tennis and just live in the hills.
It's not about being, like, you know, politically correct or in the criticism when I get levelled at this view. It's about thinking, giving your player the choice to self-determine who they are in the game world and not just assuming that they're shits.
Ian writes... Oh, no, wait.
Shut up, Ian. You've had a question.
You've had your go. Good question, though, Ian.
Yeah, thanks.
And then we have that entire discussion again.
Oh, you've lost the order.
Yeah, there's a lot of words. He sent in some really good questions this week, and I'm going to skip ahead.
Tom's fucked up the shuffling, everybody.
It's fine, it's back under control. Ben Monroe writes, "Hey there, CNC crew. Recently, I've been enjoying some classic Nintendo titles through the joys of emulation. One of my favourite Wii titles was Mario Galaxy, and my copy of the game is buried at the bottom of my wardrobe, along with my Wii. Now, I have no intention of digging out the system and connecting it up just to replay this one game, but I'm more than willing to emulate it on my PC by a dolphin. I feel no moral quandaries about doing this, as I still own the physical copy of the game, and emulating it is just my preferred way of playing. However, Nintendo cast a dark shadow over my moral justification by re-releasing the sequel on the Wii U Virtual Shop. Mario Galaxy is re-released on the Wii U. Is it still morally justifiable to emulate the game? How easily available must the game be before emulating is straight up wrong? I'd love to hear your thoughts on PC emulators. Are we heading towards a future where the next Sony console released is just a piece of software? Love the show. Cheers, guys. Ben Monroe." A squeaky legal area.
I don't think you should feel morally bad about emulating a piece of software that you already own.
I think that's
probably fine. And even if it is re-released and available in some other format, I mean, you're not obliged to rebuy it. I mean, if you wanted to, you could pull your Wii out and play it on that again.
Yeah. So, you child.
Have we not got beyond?
How many years have we had? You know we haven't, Marsh.
How long has your Wii been out?
It's always out.
Yeah.
It's like the Hulk.
Jesus.
Sorry,
you pulled those sliders.
I was going for a Mark Ruffalo quote, not a... Anyway, yeah, those... I'm just going to back out of this conversation. Bye.
Emulation is brilliant. And I'll happily confess to having emulated many, many games that I have also owned. And it's amazing, like, how... Even the remastered versions of these games don't come up to the quality that you experience on a PC, where things are just... You can run a PSP game at 10 times the resolution and then downscale it to just crisp perfection, which is what I've been doing recently with Crisis Core, because I've been on a massive nostalgic binge for Final Fantasy stuff. Irrespective of quality, I watched the dreadful Advent Children film. I replayed bits of Final Fantasy VII, and then I had to play Crisis Core, and emulation is great. We've always... over the years, PC Gamer wished to run like a double-page Mario spread, just a spread of just Mario, Marioing it up,
baiting the lawyers a bit, though,
right in the middle of PC Gamer, and of course, like you think, okay, there are actually legal issues around emulation, have to be very careful about. But yeah, I wouldn't feel bad if I were you.
Well, I mean, you own the game, and you want to just
play it on a different machine, as long as you own the game.
Exactly.
I'm not sure the law even says that, Marshall. So we recommend nothing. Have you guys emulated stuff that you're willing to admit to?
Yes. They're all games that I have owned. I don't know where most of them are now, though. I think I've lost them in house moves or stuff like that. So it's not quite clear what legal area that is, even if you were allowed to, you know, emulate games that you owned, because I'm no longer necessarily in possession of them. But P&O...
Was that the Capcom rhythm shooter? A really strange game.
What's the game with a dog in, I was going to say?
Akami.
Yes, that's the one.
Of course. Brilliant. That's how it's marketed. It's the one with a dog in, yes.
Yeah, and Shadow of the Colossus as well. I played that again on PC. It's good.
Yeah, magnificent.
Big textures.
A couple of years ago, I replayed all of Pokemon Red on a PC.
Oh, yeah.
Which is also where we get Twitch Plays Pokemon from, to be fair. That exact urge to emulate. And that's a game I bought when I was 11. So, does that still count? I'm buying it for a platform I no longer really can find?
If you did buy it again now, you'd be buying it from second-hand shops or car boot sales, and the money would never make it back to the people. I don't know. Yeah. Make a charitable donation to...
to Nintendo.
They need the money.
Yeah. Tom Sabatino asks, he says, "Gentlemen, with esports becoming more and more of a thing, do you think we'll go through an era where a multitude of inevitably mediocre games are developed and marketed not as new game, but as the next big Dota killer? I don't know the history of LoL or Smite, but I imagine these were developed as games first and esports second, and it's easy to picture a group of jaded executives reversing those. On that note, any plans on doing more Dota casting? I can't play myself, but it's a fascinating thing, and the format of having someone who knows as little as I do commenting is nice. Also, please more Dark Souls, yum yum." There will be more Dark Souls. We'll talk about that in a bit. One more thing. Ever hear of Roll20.net? It allows pen and paper RPGs to be played over the interwebs, removing the need for both pen and paper. It's not exactly PC gaming, but I would find it interesting how five professional inebriated writers could handle a game that only gets better with creative storytelling. Sorry for suddenly becoming your program director. Cheers, Tom.
This is both the most Tom Senior question ever asked.
And the most Chris Thurston question ever asked. Well done, Tom. You
do you want to start, Tom?
I'll just leave the room.
I'll just briefly talk about Roll20, because I wrote like a six-page feature about this for PC Gamer, in which we played Dungeons & Dragons using Roll20, and it was basically a thinly veiled excuse to write about pen and paper RPG design in a magazine that really has no right talking about it. But it's interesting in relation
why
to...
Why we do anything, Tom?
It's interesting in relation to gaming, because what I encountered when I played pen and paper RPGs for the first time was that I'd been trained by RPGs and video games to behave in particular ways that made me stupid and incompetent at pen and paper RPGs. So when I was presented with a switch in a dungeon, I would just pull it because I'm a gamer, and I wasn't thinking creatively, and I was thinking within the bounds that gaming has taught me. And it kind of, playing Roll20 really taught me that how limiting games really are. Like, all the habits I'd gained from growing up with games has made me creatively bankrupt when it comes to pen and paper RPGs. We'll probably pop a link to that in the show notes. Drew some pictures for it as well. Right. Now, Chris.
With regards to the notion that somehow the MOBA or the competitive game in general could be picked up by publishers in an attempt to cash in on the success of League of Legends or Dota, I would say only Dawngate. I would say Dawngate.
Firefall?
Dawngate. Firefall doesn't count because they kind of sacked its esports aspirations, but they did make it. There's been... They gave it a go, then they ungoed, and then they finally released the game. What I would say is, I think it's already happened. Like, people trying to make an eSport has already happened a bunch of times. It'll never work, for a really, really simple reason, which is that, sport isn't something people decide on behalf of a product. Sport is something a community decides on behalf of a product. If this is a sport is a title, it's something granted by, like, the people, quote unquote, not by a board of people business people who decide that that's the case. That, incidentally, or something along those lines is going to be the talk of the topic of a talk I'm giving in London in like May.
Oh, so, really?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
Why?
So, it's a Video Brains thing, which is a series of talks in London that they're doing.
Oh, cool.
So I'm involved in that later in the year. I'll probably mention it closer to the time. But yeah, so that is a topic of interest to me. But potted version is it won't work because, you know, Dota is a mod. Mods are a great example of this because they are literally created by the community. You know, the genesis of Dota is like the accelerated genesis of football, which starts with people kicking a sack from one village to the other and ends with, like, I don't know, the World Cup. Dota is a bunch of dudes making a game where you defend against waves of creeps in StarCraft 1 and then ending up with people competing for $11 million, right? Like, it's the same thing. To a greater or lesser degree. So that's why I don't think people compete, like... I think we've already seen the rise of the attempted cash-in. I haven't played a lot of these games, so I'm not talking to their quality, but, like, you do see them kind of roll out. People have realised that MOBAs are a great way to use your franchise. Mm. If you've got the DC Universe to hand, make a fucking MOBA. Because this is the replacement for make an MMO, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Elder Scrolls Online is probably going to be the last of the great, like, we've got this property, what do we do? Make an MMO. Because MMOs are really expensive and no one plays them.
What was that Middle Earth MMO? MOBA.
It's still going, actually.
Did it come out? Or is it just being made still?
What, Lord of the Rings Online? That's been out for years.
No, the MOBA.
Oh, yeah, no, it did come out. Guardians of Middle Earth.
Yeah,
that was one of the first ones on console.
Wonder how that did.
But yeah, so, like, you know, this has already happened a bunch of times. Like, it's just, because it's, you know, if you approach it from a, it's funny, you approach it from a sport community point of view, and it's like, we build loads of complex characters into our game because we want to build the skill ceiling up for people to excel at. You approach it from a business standpoint, it's like, holy shit, this is Skylanders for grown-ups. People buy the collectible figures and they make them fight.
Yeah.
Right? This is the most monetizable thing we've ever seen. Not to get back into the heroes thing, but it's the same thing.
It's going to be huge, isn't it? It's
going
to be massive.
It'll continue to be, you know, the Disney Infinity. You know, when Disney sort their shit out, it's you know, it's crazy. You've got Star Wars, Marvel. Disney. Like, basically, until I can play as Elsa from Frozen in a MOBA, this is not a problem yet. that would be rad. I don't know why I'm actually complaining. But yeah, so that I would argue that part of the question has already happened. With regard to casting, it's something I want to do more of and haven't found the time for, honestly. Like, We did actually record a cast for a Creating Crowbar community game. A replay that was submitted, myself and my friend Matt, who was on the podcast a couple months ago, did record it. It never went online. I managed to get the files out because the audio is kind of whack, and if we can reclaim it, then I'll see if we can do something of it. I think he's referring particularly to the cast that you and I did, Marsh.
Oh, right.
Where it was like, I explained it to you, which I'd be down for doing again. If you feel like it, if we find the right game to talk about. Maybe one of the games that I've been playing in this games industry tournament.
Yeah. So I haven't even seen them yet.
So yeah, my, my team in this, in the recreational, which is the Dota 2 games industry tournament, is down in the grand final of that tournament. So that'd be exciting. So I'd like to do more of it, and I'm probably going to do some more Dota casting generally, so I don't know. Yes is the vague
answer. Your Twitch stream as well, man.
Oh yeah, shit. Yeah, yeah. I do stream Dota as well, so if you, and Smite. Cause I'm getting more and more into Smite. So that's twitch.tv/exitwarp, which is the tag I use for such things. As in leaving hyperspace, because that's my favourite thing anything does.
As for Dark Souls.
Dark Souls yum yum.
Mm-hmm.
There's more of that, more yum yum coming right up.
Yes.
We've recorded a load of episodes.
A lot of it's in the YouTubes already, if we just haven't started publishing it yet, because we've been out of sync with our recording availability. But yeah. That will
it's okay, we've got some in the pipe. They'll probably go up next week, I believe. Yes. Lovely. Nick Wheeler writes, Dear Crate and or Crowbars, last week one of you fine gentlemen mentioned using achievements as a way of finding out what content you'd missed on your first playthrough. This immediately reminded me of Mask, the choose-your-own-adventure, murder, stealth, adventure, amok.
Finally, someone was mentioning it for us.
Yeah, yeah. Any opportunity, man. You've mentioned in the past, upon completing a playthrough, Mask offered up a series of scenes that you never stumbled across, a look into bizarre alternate realities, where instead of being shot in the face by a fat guy, you're playing volleyball on the beach. More games need this, and let's see what could have happened moment where you can see what might have been and even catch the lost and probably fictional Scooby-Doo ending of Mass Effect. Discuss. Or don't.
Well, there's an extra bit to his question where he asks about other.
Yes, are there any other choose your own erotic fashion murder stealth adventure maps you recommend? I consider it a rather deprived genre. Yours, Nick Wheeler.
Yes, there's sort of a fantasy erotic fashion map.
There is.
The York is in a similar vein to Mask, in as much as you make a series of kind of decisions and you bounce pachinko like down this kind of causality tree. Which ends up in very, very alarming in different places, depending on how you play it. And that's great fun. It's great. It's called YAHG. Or is it YAWHG?
No one knows.
Yeah. I think it's the latter. The Yorg. It's great. It looks gorgeous.
That's why I really like 80 Days, even though that's not on PC.
Yeah.
I think that's a similar kind of thing.
They've got to bring that to PC, haven't they?
I'd hope so.
Have they?
They've got to, yeah. Somebody must force them now.
We must ring them immediately. Craig Crowbar demands it. Fantastic. Rachel asks a question which will send us right into the navel hole from which we will never return. Hi, if you're in charge of some kind of games criticism course.
Oh God.
It's happening. God forbid. What would it be like? What would be on the curriculum? Would ludonarrative dissonance feature? Stay great and go far.
Tom, I'm trapped inside the baseball.
It's happening, Chris. It's happening. Oh my God. Imagine how awful it would be. Games criticism. Course. Yeah, but anyway, like it's funny, isn't it? What would you guys do?
I don't think it is totally absurd. I think I'd probably roll it into generalized cultural criticism until the medium matures more.
Hmm.
But you know, in general, there is value in looking at even base media.
Base media.
But there are useful things to explore. I think actually ludonarrative dissonance is one of them.
Yeah.
It's one of the ways in which our medium differentiates itself from any other narrative medium.
Hmm.
And most kind of forms of art are, at least in some part, a narrative medium.
So, something that... when I... Very, very first time I wrote anything about a game, which was way before I was even a freelancer, it was before I even considered working in this business, it was just like, I'm interested in writing this. It was because I wanted to see if it was possible to apply stuff that I'd learned doing film criticism as part of my degree, to games.
Mm.
And I had a rad film tutor, who had an approach that I would like to see emulated. So if it was my course to run, I think I would nick some of his philosophies to teaching film and apply them to games. One of them was, and obviously there are multiple philosophical approaches to any form of criticism, I have to say that. or else a load of academics appear and take away my credentials. But his approach was to say, first up, appreciate the technical execution of a thing, the methodology used to create something, as opposed to just an effect, which requires a little bit more work on the part of the critic. It's not just enough to say, this happens. You have to have some critical awareness of how. So if you're assessing a movie in that case, it's the understanding of camera technology, lighting, how you move cameras steadily. You know, if you're looking at old cinema, like, how did they get that camera to go down that flight of stairs? Like, that is not, that's not a question. It's not, that doesn't have to inform your reading of the thing, but an understanding of the methodology involved in making it happen lets you understand the limitations of what can be achieved, which allows you to understand why the decisions that were made the way they were. Mm. Like, that's really important. Because if you ignore that, you're at risk of entering Wank Town. In kind of,
you don't want to go there.
Not Wank Town.
Not for a long time. No. Like, a certain amount of time every day is fine. But if you spend all of your time there, people will start to question why you
look so tired.
Yeah, exactly. the other part of it was, it was an interesting decision. My tutor totally banned us from looking at art house cinema. And this was much the chagrin of English literature students who'd opted into a film criticism additional course. Mm. Was, I want to talk about, you know, French art movies that I like, whatever. Which is not to say that stuff isn't legitimate, but his argument was...
But by excluding that stuff, you get to something else.
Yeah. The argument was, that stuff has its criticism. Mm. Right? Like, also, it's not, because it is probably art house, because it's outlier or innovative in some way, it doesn't necessarily teach you something about the vocabulary or the mechanics or even the basic philosophy of film. Mm-hmm. So what he insisted was that he limited us to popular movies and then to help kind of balance it out, the golden age of Hollywood, which was, you know, but it was like, you know, the schlocky romantic comedies people were going to see, stuff that actually drew an audience. And part of the question you then asked is, why is this drawing an audience? How is it having the effect that it's having? How is it achieving that effect? Mm. Which I think is useful for two reasons. One, again, it brings your focus down to, like, this, I mean, which is not to say that popular approval is a barometer for quality, but it indicates something. It indicates that an effect was successfully transmitted onto people that they then recommended to other people. You know what I mean? Like, it's probably the purest proof of this actually had some effect on someone that you're going to get. And secondly, it made you kind of, consider things in terms of design effect, consider things in terms of genre and tradition, which gives you something else to bounce ideas off, and grounded it in the pragmatic reality of, in that case, film production during the kind of the great boom of cinema as it kind of spread out in lots of different directions. And I think all of those approaches are really useful, when thinking about games academically. Like, none of this stuff is necessarily useful if you're just saying, you know, reviewing a game to put a score on the end, tell someone if they should buy it.
Yeah.
Beyond a certain point. But
that's not what academic criticism is.
No, but academic criticism, I would say, and to that degree, ludonarrative dissonance is sort of more arch than that. If that's the point you get to after that. Like, I'd be much more interested in a course that said, you know, why did they choose to frame this, this sequence in a game the way they did. Like, there are lots of stuff like this has been done in games, and it's really interesting. Like, Bungie's positioning of grenades throughout all three Halo games, where it's all grenades, because they're a commodity, are almost always used to draw your eye towards set pieces in a game that doesn't really use, you know, it doesn't, like, other developers cheaped out and had to, you know, hold Y to look at the thing you want to look at button. Bungie used a different method. Robert Yang, who's written lots of good things, that I'm wondering if I like him so much as a critic, is because almost all the things that I've just said he does in one form or another, like his writing about Gone Home, which I'll put in the show notes, is really good because it's really specific. It completely approaches Gone Home as if it's a take on the Thief genre, like the Looking Glass kind of thing, which no one else was doing at the time because people were leaping ahead in a way to not in a bad way, but they were leaping ahead to like the social issues raised by the game or something else. They weren't looking at like the nuts and bolts of how it was put together.
Yeah.
And what it was drawing on, and everyone else was treating it like it was this like out of the blue thing that no one had done before. And his argument was, look at the things this has in common with other first person exploration games. Mm. That I really appreciate. And he did something for PC Gamer that unfortunately isn't available online because we put it in the magazine and involved extensive infographics, but it was an excerpt from his book, so I don't know if that book was subsequently released. But that was about the construction of two sequences from Half-Life, the tram sequence at the beginning and the Ixthiosaur sequence from later in the game. Mm. And that was really interesting, because again, it was about how a mundane effect, relative, I mean, it was impressive at the time, but, you know, it's not a tremendous, it's not an artistic effect, right? Like, that's a really shitty way of putting it. Mm-hmm. So it didn't have a message. Mm-hmm. It was just like, how is this interesting effect achieved within the technical limitations of the time? And how did it succeed at being effective for a lot of people? Like, a lot of it was like making sure you're facing the right way when the shark tank dunks you in the water with the ichthyosaur, like stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, that was a long answer, but that's the stuff I'm really interested in. And that thing is often lacking.
How do things create their effect?
Yeah.
It is a good thing.
What are they actually doing?
I wrote last week about the aesthetics of puzzle game design for Rock Paper Shotgun, which is much the same sort of thing. How your actual interaction with a thing has its own aesthetic is a thing that isn't discussed in sort of media which doesn't have interaction, I think. And it's the entire purpose of games is to be interactive.
It's interesting crossing over from studying literature to criticising games that they're like in when someone writes a book they build the world entirely and there are like no hard limits on what they can really express unless it's stuff that's completely socially unacceptable. Like it's like there are social boundaries on what they can say, but beyond that they can build these worlds however they want. Whereas there are huge business constraints and just like mechanical constraints and technological restraints on the stuff people could do in games even today that means you can't go into criticise a thing and say, why didn't it do this impossible thing that it could never have done? Because it's completely unfair to the people who have made it who could never have realised that. And it's kind of, I think you are required to understand the constraints that people are working under, especially with mainstream games where they could never do certain things because it'd just be unviable for them. And to ask it of them is sometimes unreasonable. Hmm. But, I guess like the fun thing about this question is, Cortex, like what games would you have people study? Just quickly, just name two or three.
Half-Life 1.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to go in the circle because it would help me to think a little bit more.
Yeah.
any multiplayer game from the kind of Quake 3, early 2000s era as well. On the number of tournament. Those kind of games which encourage flow and those kind of things. I think those are interesting.
Mm. I'd put Ikwiga in there.
StarCraft.
Mm.
I'd say Half-Life 1, StarCraft. It's a pat answer, but Tetris, actually. Just as sort of like really simple design that's only possible because of digital systems.
English Country Tune. Just a
Euro Truck Simulator 2. That's the final text. Listeners, have your essays in by next week's podcast, please. 1,600 words, with fully referenced, of course. But for now, that's all the questions we have questions for. And it's time to say goodbye.
But not before giving you a series of instructions about further communication with the people in this room and two people who aren't in it. If you would like to send us a question for a future episode, you can email us at questions@creightoncrowbar.com. You can leave a question on our forum at creightoncrowbar.com/forum, which is also where you find our discussion boards for each episode, people to play games with, people to Photoshop my face onto my face with, and so on. You can tweet us at Creighton Crowbar on Twitter, or you can tweet us as individuals. Tom Sr. is...
at PCG Ludo. Ludo.
Like ludonarrative dissonance.
Mm. I regret picking that wanky name. That's fine. On the internet all those years ago.
Just a legacy of your time in Wanktown.
forever. Part of me lives there still.
Anyway. Marsh?
I'm Marsh Davis, as in Marsh Narrative Dissonance.
And I'm C. Thurston, CTHURSTEN, as in wanker.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
Goodbye.